Hello there, and welcome to the Bandroom Podcast. My name is Dylan Maddox.
And I'm Kate Nishimura.
And let me just say nothing, because I am speechless.
Yeah, me too. We just had an incredible, life-changing, life-affirming conversation with the wonderful Alex Shapiro, composer, activist, writer, speaker, amazing person.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I think that's one of the kind of biggest takeaways from this conversation and many others that I've heard other places, that she is someone you cannot there. If you tried to stick a label on this person, it would just fall off, because she is,
yeah,
she is Alex Shapiro. And it is amazing to see and hear, see for us, because we could see. about all of the things that she's done, all of the areas of study that she is, and I'm laughing for a reason that I'll tell you shortly. Well, not really, I won't tell you. But before we share that episode with you,
please do us a huge favor and head over to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts like this one. And please give the Bandroom Podcast a rating and a review. It really helps others to find the podcast, and that is what we want.
Absolutely. And the reason I'm laughing so much is just because we recorded a bonus episode that that's what made me speechless the most, and like I'm still crying, yeah, laughing. Like
it's the new benchmark for bonus episode. Like it's really just, yeah.
It was, I just don't know what to say. It's not selling this too much to say that this information about Alex Shapiro, composer extraordinaire, has never been shared in a public forum such as this. Mm-hmm. And if you want to hear this amazing bonus episode, you can do that by becoming a patron of the Bandroom Podcast through Patreon. So if you visit patreon.com/bandroompod, you will become privy to all the bonus episodes, as well as the ones that we've already recorded, the one we did with Alex, as well as some other behind the scenes content. If you look at the tiers, even if you're willing to donate high enough, there's some Bandroom merch that you could get as well.
Very exciting.
So go check that out. It was a great conversation, let alone the bonus episode. But the what you're about to hear was just, as I said, the highlight of my month. It was, it was great.
Yeah, absolutely.
So without further ado, here is our conversation with the amazing Alex Shapiro. So here we are for another exciting Bandroom Podcast, and we've already had the greatest conversation already before the interview even happened. And
it's downhill from here, folks.
Yeah, I know.
You can tune out now.
Both Kate and I are super excited to welcome the amazing, the phenomenal Alex Shapiro. Welcome to the Bandroom, Alex.
I am so happy to be in the Bandroom.
No, this is wonderful. You were on my I have to say our now. I need to get used to it. our guest list for a long time, and we the stars aligned, and you are here, which is phenomenal. I must say, the first thing I'm going to say, and I told Kate I wanted to ask this, and it wasn't on the list of questions I sent. But has anyone ever asked you? Have you ever done, like, we were joking about it, but have you ever done radio? Because you have the most amazing radio voice.
Thank you.
I was always wondering.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes.
A long time ago when I was working in Hollywood, I occasionally would help out with voiceover gigs, very occasionally. So I've done a little of it, but I never hung my shingle out to do it, so to speak. But I have done that, yeah.
Well, I'm sure this will be your big break, kid.
I'm hoping. Hey, anybody out there wants to agent me in the voiceover world?
You can have my number.
I could feel that buzz in my whole body.
Yeah. Well, Now let's
I always thought I should be like a late night classical music DJ because, you know, I'd make the music sound just so sultry and so interesting.
I thought I had a good feeling about this, but that was amazing. So that being said, now for something completely different. The other thing I want to say is you are probably one of the best documented guests we've had. And I'm saying that so you listeners can go listen to every interview Alex has ever given. There's so many phenomenal articles that I'm sure we're going to talk about and all that stuff. So we're gonna dive deep here. And the first question that we're going to ask is, how did you find your way into the band world, and what was it that made you stay?
Ooh, and I think the most important thing is what was it that made me stay? Because in a sense, with all that ultra documentation that's out there, I'm sure so many people, especially people who might be listening to this wonderful podcast, they have probably heard the story a gazillion times about how then commander and now far higher ranking Todd A. Addison found me through MySpace. Everybody's heard that story. I'm not going to tell it again. You can find that a million times. It's a great story. Yes, and the army trolling for talent on MySpace. It was awesome. But everybody knows that story if they've listened. But the thing that keeps me in the band world, and it's now been 12 years or so since then, has been the people and the artistic opportunity. I mean, that's the thing that really gets to me. And I'm sure you guys would feel the same way that, you know, I've worked in a lot of different aspects of the music industry, in the commercial world, in the chamber music world. You know, I've been a little jazz, a little pop. I mean, you corporate videos. I mean, you name it. I've been in all these weird corners of the business. And there's something so beautiful and marvelous and heartwarming about our colleagues in the band world. They are so welcoming. Artistically, I find it to be incredibly rewarding because you can have any persona at any time musically. And there's going to be some wacky band director out there who's going to love whatever bizarre thing you do and say, great, you know, as opposed to, you know, sometimes in the hoity-toity end of the classical music world, people expect you to be a little bit more in a box, you know, one way or the other. Certainly in the work for hire world, when it comes to commercial music, you have to be in a box. You have to be in someone else's box because they are paying you from that box. You are being paid to be in the box with them, and it's their box, and they've decided what the box looks like. That's cool. I totally get that. I'm fine with that. But it wasn't what I wanted to keep doing, you know. But so the thing that keeps me in the band world is the intense sense of joy, artistically and with colleagues. It's so much fun. You know, we even over Zoom this past year, I have felt so close to so many, you know, composers and directors and musicians in general. And it's magic. You know, I always say that you have to surround yourself in life, if you can, with everything that makes you feel good and people that bring out the best in you and hopefully that you can help bring out the best in too. And that, so it ticks all those boxes, you know?
Right. Well, we're happy you're here. Yeah. Very happy. In the band world, that is. Also the podcast. But, and I want to bring up a point that you made, and it's, you know, I feel like the band world, and I don't want to put a globe or a bubble around us or anything like that, but I feel probably that one of the more living composer friendly of the ensembles. And I know Kate and I both studying in Toronto had an opportunity to work with Michael Colgrass, and he's someone who preached this composers writing for the wind band. So we're so happy that you do.
Thank you. And you know, it's the minute I joined the band world all those years ago in 2008, it was my first Midwest clinic. That's what sealed the deal right there. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Todd telling me that I needed to go. I said, what, do I look like I'm sick? Why should I go to this Midwest clinic? He said, you have to explain to me what it was. And I'm so glad I went because that's what, you know, completely changed my life. And it's absolutely true. I started screaming from the rafters even back then because, believe it or not, just 12 years ago, there weren't nearly this many composers going to that conference. You know, it's really changed a lot. And I was telling everybody, check this out. This is a world that wants us. It's a world that is building repertoire, is excited about new repertoire, and there are no rules. You can do any kind of music you want to do, and someone will play it, you know? Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more.
I totally agree with everything you've said about how open-minded the band world can be. And it's a wonderful place for composers of all experience levels, I think, to try new things and really explore their voices. So we are glad that you're here and here to stay. So many of us envy the incredible view from your home studio. I'm looking at the tech side of your studio now, but I know on the other side of the camera is an amazing view outside, and you have all these opportunities to interact with wildlife. Oh, there it is.
There
some
it
islands,
is.
Some water, beautiful sunset happening.
Yep.
And I know
just
that you
missed a little bit of hail, as a matter of fact.
Oh, no.
It's very exciting. About half an hour ago, I was literally thinking, oh, this is going to really interfere with the mic because I have a metal roof and a skylight and everything. It's going to be so loud.
Built-in percussive background music.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that you consider yourself to be an activist and a naturalist in addition to being a composer. And I was wondering if you could talk about how your surroundings and how your passion for the environment impacts and inspires the work that you do.
And, you know, it's funny. It's connected to that answer we were talking about before about surrounding yourself with that which makes you happiest. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the direct correlation between my music and the wildlife and the natural world that I'm in. I grew up in New York City, in Manhattan, as some of the listeners probably already know, and migrated out west when I was 21 to LA for 24 years. And then 14 years ago, moved up to this island, and almost 13 years. And it's very interesting because it's worth saying, since I was talking about being in the band world for 12 years, really 13, if you count when the commission opportunity came to be from Todd. Guess what happened at the same time? When I made my life look like what I really, really wanted it to look like, all of a sudden my professional life seriously opened up mm-hmm. in ways that I never, ever would have expected. I never in a million years thought I was going to be in the band world. I was a total non-band kind of person. You know, I knew nothing about this world. And I think, and that and a number of other things kind of all collided and happened around 2007, 2008, the same time I moved to this island. And I don't think that's an accident. I'm a big believer in that everything resonates with everything else in our lives, that when you make choices that are really good for you and for your heart and for your sense of well-being, that's going to reflect out. You're going to be bringing down whatever kinds of emotional barriers that you might have been feeling. And the universe, with a capital U, kind of senses that and floods you with opportunities, as opposed to if you're not quite right with yourself or with where you are or whatever's going on in your life, there is a bit of a barrier. You know, there's something you might be saying, you know, with one hand, ooh, I really want, you know, X, Y, and Z, whatever the thing is, with that hand. But there's another hand that's holding up the kind of the stop sign saying, no, no, no. And you don't even realize you're doing that. And I promise this is about as woo-woo as I'm going to get. It's all those years in Southern California that fried my brain. But I really believe in this. I really do. And I think that that's the correlation between my work and me always feeling secure to jump off cliffs and try different things with my work. It has a lot to do with how happy I am living on the edge of this island, staring out to this great expanse and just this ever-changing vista. It's amazing. And so that inspires the vistas internally, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes perfect sense to me. And I'll take a moment to say that you have inspired me. I actually moved. We were talking about this before we started recording, but I made a big move in the fall. And I have noticed a difference myself in being in a different kind of environment. It opens my mind up to different possibilities. I really believe in that as well. And I think it's great that you've been able to do that.
That's beautiful. There's one other thing I'll add to that, which may or may not hold water. I mean, I welcome anybody to email me and say, you're full of it. But here's my thought about this, because I have lived in really, really big cities and I've lived in the middle of nowhere. So I speak from personal experience that there is something about when you're in a big, big, big city with a lot of big, important people and a lot of big, important expectations and musical literati, as I jokingly call them, and all of that, that there is at least subconsciously some sense somewhere of having to feel like you need that approval in some weird way, you know, that you need to kind of fit in with that scene in some way. And it doesn't have to be such an obvious thing. It's just something that maybe people feel inside a little bit. And what happens when you leave the city and when you distance yourself from the place where it all happens, you know? Because I guarantee you, there is virtually no new music scene on Little San Juan Island. And when you get away from that, all of those vibrations go away. And the only thing that you're hearing and paying attention to is your own striving for excellence and your own approving of yourself. And what are you doing that is speaking to your own authenticity? So I do think that there's something to be said for not being in the middle of everything, you know, and distancing mm-hmm. yourself from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So going along with all of that, actually, on your website, you have a quote that says, "Knowing a bit about a composer as a person adds to the perception of her music," which I think is beautiful. And you set this example through your notes from the Kelp blog. Dylan and I were laughing the other day about how I'm pretty sure this is the only guest we'll ever have where we use the word kelp in regular conversation. But, you know, you share so much with your community through this blog, through the photography you do on your website and everything. And I was wondering if you could tell us why you approach your work and your life in this way.
Unfortunately, it's probably the answer is because I can't not. I am what we'd call an extroverted introvert. So left to my own devices, I am extremely happy for days and weeks at a time in this room, by myself even. Really, I'm very happy alone. I grew up very isolated and very much alone as an only child with rather odd parents who did not like children and didn't allow me to have anybody over. So I was very isolated growing up. And as a result, I think this helped me probably become an artist, because when you spend that much time by yourself and have nobody to play with, you do, your mind, you know, becomes very active and you create your own worlds. So that's, it ended up, while it didn't feel great at the time, it probably ended up being a real asset. But I think that I can't not be connected to all these other things and find, just naturally have a holistic way of representing them all. To me, there isn't a delineation between any of these things that I love and do and reach out and do or do internally. It's all one flow of a happy life. And, you know, I often find myself making food analogies because I love to eat. My husband is a wonderful cook. I am a superb eater. That is my talent. And a wine bottle opener too. I'm very good at opening bottles of booze. But I'm expert. But I think it's like food, where you don't think of your life as separate from eating all these different kinds of food throughout the week. It's just a natural thing that you do, is you eat all these different kinds of food. And some of the foods are from very different groups or very different countries, you know, in terms of what spices and flavors they are and ingredients. And life is like that, right? We're not just one thing. So to me, there's this unstoppable connection and a hunger to try. I have so much curiosity about everything that there's this curiosity and hunger that I just want to experience everything all the time. And I can't just only do this. Like this morning is a good example. I had, you know, I have a lot of writing to do right now on a deadline. Don't we all, right? You know, this is not new for anybody.
Not me.
But, okay, maybe not you. You got a lot of stick waving to do.
Yeah.
But still, I allow myself to be interrupted by a whole lot of things that are in other quadrants of my brain and life, because ultimately when I do swivel back here to face these screens, it all comes out somehow in that, you know? And also, you're also working on this stuff subconsciously when you're doing other things as well. So it's all connected. Do you feel that way, Kate?
I do, yeah. I mean, I think the feedback that I get from people in the community is that people enjoy learning about the person who created the music that they're working on, whether that's, you know, more formally learning about where the music came from and what it was inspired by, but also just finding out things like, oh, she loves, you know, plants and she has two cats and she eats a plant-based diet, you know, like things like that. It just helps to shape, you know, students and musicians' views of who composers are, what composers look like and live like. And I think that's important.
And they can see themselves in that composer, and they can see themselves, oh, that person, you know, puts her pants on one leg at a time, so to speak, right?
You know? Hey, me too.
Me too. It's amazing. You know? But Mason Curry did that great book, and I'm blank. It's right behind me in my room behind me, and I'm blanking on the title, and I feel terrible about it. I love it. It's all these interviews with composers about what's their daily life like. You know, it's the minutiae of daily life, and I love reading that stuff. Anne McCutcheon did a book like that years ago. Same thing. The capturing of these moments of what people's daily lives are like, when the musicians read that and or fellow composers, whatever, it connects them in a deeper way to the music and to where that all comes from. And it reflects the person reading it in a very human way. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now that we're all like Zoom rock stars all the time, all of us, right? We're constantly, you know, in these little boxes doing our thing. And, I think that heightens that sense of connectivity and the expectation of connectivity. It used to be, before all of this, you know, it's only been the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years that composers increasingly were expected to get up to the lip of the stage and talk to audiences at concerts. Mm-hmm. That did not used to be the norm, not nearly as much as it has in the 21st century. And now Zoom has brought us even further into that, where, hey, let everybody into your house and social media too, right? Let everybody see your cats and let them see your laundry basket and all that stuff, right? So anyway, I just wanted to toss that in.
Kate's cat made an appearance on last week's podcast.
She did.
Yeah. Aww. Although highly useless for a podcast because you can't see it. But still. So now here's my all-star segue. Speaking of books, you've had the opportunity to contribute to a number of books, and most recently, past Bandroom podcast guest Dr. Eric Lung's collection of stories and things in The Horizon Leans Forward. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your contribution to the book, and maybe even just the importance of the book as a whole.
Yeah, Eric is so wonderful. And he came up with this idea not that long ago, frankly. It all came together really, really quickly. Mm-hmm. To put together a book regarding underrepresented communities in the conducting and composing world, and to have a bunch of co-authors, each one coming from one of those segments of the world, to talk about their experiences and lay out the experiences and observations of that world. And some people did a really amazing historical overview as well, with a lot of interviews, like Courtney Snyder is one of the writers, one of the authors, and she interviewed several women conductors, and the oldest one is like 90 years old or something. Wow. I mean, that's a long, long bit of history to think about conducting at a time when women just were not, you know, not thought of very much in that world. And if we think it's bad now, boy, was it worse then. So that's just one example. My chapter is called Reaching Out and Bringing Women In. And it's sort of an activist chapter in that I'm not looking backwards. I'm not a historian or a scholar at all. I'm not looking at the overview of here's what the past, you know, 100 years or 500 years have been like. What I'm looking at is, because, you know, I've had 12 solid years in the band world and a lot of observations, it's sort of a two-part chapter. It's like, first of all, here's a really good laundry list of biases and issues that a lot of people don't even realize is going on. And a lot of the people who carry these biases don't realize, you know, that their behavior and their lack of thought is perpetuating some of these problems. And it's easy to solve, because with everything that I point out, I offer a bit of a solution, like, well, you know, if we just do this, or here's something that you can do, or whatever, you know, I offer some suggestions. The second part is sort of a guidebook, a handbook from three different prongs, if you will, three different viewpoints of, if you are someone who's already established in the field, what can you do to help one of these underrepresented people? In my case, I'm talking about women, but it's applicable to absolutely everybody. What can you do to help bring them in to the field, help introduce them to people, give them resources, turn them on to different things that are going to improve their lives and their creativity? If you happen to be one of those women, what should you be doing to improve your career? What's that laundry list? And it's a long one of things that you have to do to make the effort that are really going to make a big difference. And then finally, because Eric asked me to make it somewhat autobiographical, I ping back to some of my own experiences. Mm-hmm. And as I said recently in a webinar when I was talking about this book, I said my regret about my chapter is that I wanted to be so encouraging that I only talked, as I recall, I pretty much only talked about things that I did that worked out pretty well because, hey, this worked for me. Maybe it'll work for you too, right? But what I also should have done is said, here are all my bonehead maneuvers from the past that I did that please do not do this. Do not do this. Don't do what I did, you know? Yeah. And that would be very helpful too. But anyway, that's my chapter. The chapter, every one of these chapters is a gem. And it also has a very significant annotated bibliography at the end of the book, which is probably a third of the book is that. And it's called The Horizon Leans Forward. Eric is just wonderful. And his vision for this was just unmatched. And Alec Harris, who's the president of GIA Publications, we just did a webinar with him a couple of weeks ago for the book. And Alec flat out said, he opened the webinar, and I'm paraphrasing, but not by much. He said he thinks it's the most significant book that GIA has ever published.
Wow.
And it was really, he's over the moon about it. And he feels that it's so important for these stories to be told and to show these, have these biases, see the light of day, have the history, which is not always a very pleasant history, see the light of day in this perspective from within the band world and from composers and conductors who are currently working in the band world, whether we are sensing that we're being discriminated against or not. In my case, it's very much the or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I have been very fortunate in my life. I have never come across, to my knowledge, any obstacles. But that does not mean that I don't observe very keenly what's going on around me. So it was such an honor to be asked to write a chapter for this.
Yeah, and what a wonderful resource and gift and eye-opening document that is for all of us, not only in this field, but in every field in music that is going to benefit from that work.
And I'm excited.
And we're going to have, because Rob Miller's going to come on soon as well. So that's another one of the authors checked
out. Oh, Rob Taylor, you mean, right?
Oh, who did I say?
Rob Miller, euphonium player.
Oh, yeah, we don't want him.
No euphonium players.
Yeah. Sorry, Yamaha.
Can't have that.
We want Rob Taylor.
Oh, Rob is so yeah. wonderful. I mean, they're all so wonderful, and they're all friends, and Rob is just the best. So,
and
a fellow Canadian now. He's up
I
there.
I know. We're stealing them all.
I'm looking out to Vancouver right there.
Right, yeah. And I was just thinking of something you said very early on in that response. You know, sometimes maybe those of us that are conductors and happen to be white males, you know, we're not we tell ourselves we're not actively doing anything to, you know, stop women conductors or composers of color or anything like that. But just the pure act of being passive about it is that. And I think that it's a really wonderful reminder that we need to be active. We need to be thinking. You need to take consideration in every choice when it comes to programming and who's going to be your guest artist and who's and all that stuff. So
exactly. And, you know, I say that in the book, and I've said it for years before, because I've had the chance to speak all over the world on gender inequity issues. And one of the points I make front and center is that the majority of people, and let's take the band world, the majority of conductors are not at all intentionally discriminatory. They are wonderful people. They, as you say, they're not trying actively to shut anybody out. It's just that it hasn't been brought to their attention that they're not looking more closely at their repertoire choices, at their curation, at their commissioning choices, at this, that, the other. You know, all it takes is to be tapped on the shoulder by somebody in the nicest of way. You don't have to be hostile about it, and just say, hey, have you looked at the past few years of your programming? Look at how many people of color and women and other kinds of people are that are not just, you know, straight white males are represented by those composers. And they really haven't taken a look from that perspective. And when they do, it's very eye-opening. Mm-hmm. So, and changes are made so quickly. So it's the kind of thing that's an easy fix. It's so easy to change the face of music. It's harmless. It's painless. You know, it takes very little effort. And now there are so many resources, you know, whether it's the Institute for Composer Diversity or a gazillion other resources and links. I have one on my page that if for anybody listening, go to my website and you'll see shortly down the page, you know, programming resources. You know, are you looking for to broaden the scope of your composers, et cetera, and in your sphere? Mm-hmm. Here, click here. And it's a really long list of aggregated links.
We'll make sure to include a link in the episode description for this podcast.
Absolutely.
Great.
And we've discussed the idea of writer's block, or I guess we'll call it composer's block. I don't know. quite a bit with composers on the podcast. I'm thinking about Pete Meakin. We've talked about it. With Dale Trumbore, we've talked about it. And her book is very helpful for that. But I know that you have some thoughts on what causes this and how to get through it, as well as ways to help students, you know, take that that first leap off the cliff into the world of composition.
I do, because, you know, every artist deals with this all the time. And we deal with it also when we're on deadlines and maybe things aren't flowing and you have to just have faith. It's very much a faith-based activity is what composing is. You just have to have faith that, you know, the ideas are going to come to you. But I have a theory that I actually got a chance to write a little bit about in a chapter for an earlier book that from GIA, also called Musicianship, Composing in Band and Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And it's the chapter's called Releasing a Student's Inner Composer. But one of the things I say in it is applicable to anybody, whether you're a student or a seasoned pro with salt and pepper and everything, seasoned pro like me. The thing is that the writer's block is coming, in my opinion, that paralysis is coming from a fear of not being perfect and a fear of not being approved of, a fear of not being good enough. And when we have all those fears front and center, it's paralyzing to the point where we can't get a note out on the page or a word if you're a writer or anything else. That is a kind of paralysis that's coming from our own internal mental state. And thankfully, it can also be dropped and left at the curb, too, because of that. We can have control over that by simply giving yourself permission and realizing, first of all, nobody is perfect. There is no such thing as perfection. That doesn't exist. And if it did, it would be incredibly boring. I mean, we just wouldn't want a world filled with so-called perfect humans, because that's called AI robots or something. We will be living in that world soon enough, and it will be awful. you know, the perfection thing is just kind of horrifying. And it, the best thing you can do for yourself when you're feeling stumped is to just say, I'm just going to let something flow out. I don't care how crap it is. I'm just going to let it flow, because that's what the other end of the pencil is for, called the eraser. That's what the other key up here is for, called the delete button, you know, this or the new file, or, you know, save as, name, you know, keep what you've done that's crap and just move on. Name it, add another number to the file name and start again. And that way, you know, you can always go back to what you did if you really want it, but you just be fearless going forward and just let things come out. And you don't have to like all of it or any of it. But by doing it, you will find that some stuff comes out that you actually do like, and that's worthy of your attention, and therefore maybe someone else's attention. Mm-hmm. And then you can work around that. And then one of the things I do, I've been working with both university and high school students, even a few middle schoolers, on an online syllabus that I created last year when the pandemic hit. That is called Putting the E in Ensemble. And it's a way to get these musicians who none of them mostly had composed before. They are all, you know, orchestra or band musicians at their schools. It's a way of getting them to open up and actually compose short mm-hmm. motives at first, or motifs, and however you want to pronounce it, and then turning all this collection of short motives into actual pieces of music. And one of the things I tell them about when I'm trying to open them up, because some of them are, you know, rather terrified. You know, how can I possibly do this? I am a euphonium player. I am not a composer, you know. Right. And I say, you know, hey, my work often starts over there. It starts usually in two places, either over there on my sofa, where I lie down and think about the gestures and think about what it is emotionally I want to say and what kind of journey I'm taking people on. I also use a hot shower for this purpose. I am like the cleanest composer because ever, because I'll just get in that. I have a big suite here, this wing of the house, and I've got a big, big bathroom behind me. So I'll just hop in the shower, get in the hot water. It's great. just at wherever, either lying down, I'm sleeping or bathing, basically.
There you go.
One or the other. But, you know, you think, I tell them to do that. I tell them to write down adjectives and adverbs and maybe a description, you know, with words about what they're hearing. And then I tell them to draw. And I say, you do not have to be Picasso. You just take out some colored pencils or pens or something and have a great time drawing what you think you're hearing and stay in the gesture. And I always assure them, I say, you know, I stay as far away from the manuscript paper as I possibly can for as long as I can, because I want to stay in that gestural side of the brain. And I don't want to have to be solving goddamn math problems while I'm trying to write a piece of music, you know,
yeah.
Because, right, how many times, Kate knows this, how many times do you hear some amazing gesture and then you realize, oh, crap, I've got to write this down in a way that's going to make mathematical sense so somebody can read this and play it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that stops you right in your tracks.
Yeah.
It just does. And so the idea is stay away from it as long as you can to get those ideas, you know, corralled, and then, you know, then have at it. Assuming human beings are involved in the playing. If you're only writing electronic music, hey, it's great. No math problem. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think as a high school student, I did compose. But I just like you said, if you were in my life, Alex, who knows? I did have an immense fear of just, you know, just writing down what was in my head, or maybe a lack of skill and smarts. That was probably what it was. But
no, you see, that's the thing. You don't need skill. You don't need smarts. You just need permission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really, you just need the permission to set yourself free, because everybody has something to say.
Mm.
We all speak, you know, we all communicate and have friends and, you know, have relationships, and we all have a heart and something to communicate. It's just that I think it's drilled out of young people from a very early age, where everybody's saying no to them. You're not a this, or you can't do that, or you're doing it wrong, or right? And anytime, I was a very sensitive little girl. I mean, I'm still a very sensitive old woman now, but I was a very sensitive little girl. And anytime somebody said no to me, I just crumpled, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I grew out of that. I figured out a way to take care of myself. But I was constantly being kept in a box and being said no to.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I now know what it feels like very much to be in that miserable place. And so now I want to help other people get out of the box.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such good advice. If you think about, you know, when you're a kid and you have such a vivid imagination, whether it's dreams and nightmares or just daydreams and thinking about things that you don't have answers to yet, as adults, we lose that a little bit as we go through life. And I think, you know, if you're able to harness that again, it can be really liberating and really exciting. So,
absolutely. You know, this is one of the reasons, Kate, that I always think sleep. And if you're lucky enough to be someone who dreams, you know, at some point in your sleep, because some people don't. But mm-hmm. I think REM, you know, that deep sleep is so important for our mental health and for our creativity. And that is where so much problem solving gets done, is when we're sleeping. It not only, you know, your brain is literally healing itself, as is your body when you're sleeping. You're kind of rebuilding. And I think it's such a deep mental state of sleeping that just gets us to all kinds of wonderful places, especially dreaming, even if the dreams are anxiety dreams. You know, you're working them out. That's why they're there. You're working them out, and then you wake up and suddenly you're not an axe murderer. It's good. It's a good day when you wake up and you're not an axe murderer. So
yeah.
Now there's a quote from a podcast.
Yeah.
Well, last week we talked about if you had to choose a band instrument to use as a weapon during a zombie apocalypse, what band instrument would it be? I want to hear Alex Shapiro's answer.
There are, you know, that's a good one. There's so many possibilities, because it depends on whether you blow through it or bonk somebody over the head with it.
Exactly.
You know? I mean, really.
Yeah.
I mean, the trombone, of course, is an obvious choice for having many arm's length possibilities, because what I like about the trombone for this purpose of violence is that self-defense is that, you know, you can really let that slide out with a powerful elbow, right? However, It's very much like the reason you don't want to use a shotgun or any kind of long-armed rifle for home defense. When you're going around a corner, your assailant, would-be assailant, can grab the butt of it. I mean, the bore of it, mm-hmm. and use it against you. And so that could happen with a trombone. I just want everybody listening to know trombones could be problematic for self-defense because somebody can easily grab it from you, as opposed to a little oboe. Now, it's short. You got that sharp reed. You could stab someone and really at least annoy the hell out of them with an oboe reed. I mean, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, there are many possibilities.
Because I, you know, Kate and I talked about it. We thought we had a great answer. But then today in my wind methods class, after it, a student knew I was asking this question to Kate earlier. So she asked what we said, and she gave her response. She's like, yeah, you think you'd want something smaller just for the reason that you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Ah, there See, you go. Great minds.
Anyway.
You know, it's the difference between having a little Glock in, you know, in your purse versus, you know, a 22-aught, you know, shotgun or something, or a 12-gauge shotgun.
I'll refrain from any American jokes.
Yeah. No. We'll pivot here.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, folks. All you need to get out of your creative block is a good nap and a good shower.
and a trombone.
Sorry, Thomas. We
For
love you.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, so, Alex, the first time I came across your music, I was a university student, and we were working on your piece Immersion with the Wind Ensemble, and it was the first electroacoustic piece that I had ever been a part of. So really, really positive memory for me to think about. And I was so surprised to find out that you were relatively new to the band world at that time. And I later learned that you have an extensive career in commercial music and writing for professional players and other things before coming to the band world and writing for students. So I was wondering how your compositional approach compares when writing for students or less experienced musicians to more professionals and commercial music.
Yeah, I think that's so cool you played Immersion. That was under Jillian?
Yes.
Was that? Yeah, yeah, she's the best.
She really is.
She is just so great.
She's okay. Okay, she's great. I love her.
The approach actually, here's an interesting take on it, that when you're writing commercial music for commercial purposes, almost always you're writing on a ridiculously tight deadline and studio time is extremely expensive. On a scoring stage or even in a smaller environment, depending, you know, no matter what number of instrumentalists you have. And it has to be right because you're only going to get a chance to read it down once or twice and then it's on to the next cue. And this is just something that's drilled into you when you're working, you know, in the commercial realm. And it's a good skill set to have for anybody. So what I find the connective tissue is between writing pieces for that purpose and then writing pieces for, let's say, students, which I really enjoy, that some of my pieces, you know, the thing I'm writing now is very professional level, but but just as easily I'm doing pieces at the same time that are like, I'm about to start a 0.5.
Nice.
And I've got a, you know, grade twos and grade threes coming up. I love doing that stuff too. The connective tissue is this, being logical and making sense out of something in a very simple and straightforward way. When you're dealing with pro musicians, it's about time. Of course, they can play anything, but what, you know, you want something to be able to be read down and sound really great, certainly by the second take, if not on the first. Sometimes you can do one take and print it and that's it, you move on. And with that, there's a simplicity and an economy of thought when it comes to putting music on the page. And it doesn't mean it has to be dumb music at all. It can be very sophisticated, but you're thinking about how the instruments work, what's idiomatic to them, what's going to be playable, yada, yada, yada. Well, those are exactly the same things you're thinking about with students, except that instead of the whole range of instrument, they've got maybe six good notes. You know, that's there's just a difference, maybe less. There's that difference depending on what age level you're writing for. But the concept is very similar. Writing in a way that makes sense and writing logically for them. That's how I approach it. You know, I never feel musically limited. Writing for younger students. I'm not going to limit my musical vocabulary. I'm going to write mixed meters, chromaticism, syncopations, all that stuff. I'm just going to do it in a way that they, with their more limited skill sets, can understand.
Yeah, that's great. And I think it's so important for people to hear composers speak about things like that, because there's this misconception that music for younger players or less experienced players is easier or more simple or just doesn't have as much substance to it. And I totally disagree. I think that it's very possible to achieve really, really deep and meaningful, you know, performances through music, even at a young age and with only six notes or whatever you have access to.
Absolutely. And you know what? Our job as composers is to inspire these kids so that they want to keep playing. And when I listen to some of the pablum of yore, you know, that's been around in the repertoire for a long time, I just want to shoot myself. It's like, what if I were that fifth grade or sixth grade or seventh grade clarinetist? What in the world about this piece, this plodding, slow 4/4 thing that has only, you know, major notes and it's just, I don't know. There's something that annoys me so much about that kind of music. And what is it about that that ever would have made me want to keep playing the clarinet? You know, that it is maybe because you're ever hopeful that you'll get to play some cooler sounding stuff. But my attitude is give them something to latch on to really right away, no matter what it is. Give them something that's going to challenge them. Don't dumb things down. You can write very sophisticatedly without dumbing it down for them, because especially these days, kids are really sophisticated. They're exposed to everything nonstop in media. So it's not like they haven't heard every kind of music already. It's just a matter of, I think here, especially in the United States, there are so many limitations put on them by dint of the limits of the repertoire that's put in front of them from an early age. And one of my missions is to kind of work on that a little bit through my the subterfuge of my little bit of catalog that's for younger players, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I picture. You showed us earlier in before we started recording, you showed us that little action figure. So I picture action figure Alex just ripping down all these walls and being like, yeah. Because you're really great, and don't take this the wrong way, but you're really great at taking very intimidating musical concepts, maybe something like 12-tone rows or improvisation, even, who knows, a water gong, which I'm not personally intimidated by water gongs, but maybe some people are. And I was wondering, is this something when you began writing for young ensembles that it was an important idea? Because I know certainly me, a little island boy, did not know anything about 12-tone row. And my first year, we were able to do Tight Squeeze here. And I know a lot of my students, you know, they come from very far north. They come from all over Ontario. They wouldn't have had any experience. So it was so great that we could share that.
That's my sneaky way, you know, Tight Squeeze is a good example of that, how to get, you know, super duper syncopation and super duper chromaticism all under the same roof in just 3 minutes, folks. You know, I didn't set out. Bebop scales, yep, the whole thing. And certainly the rhythms. It's like a jazz big band chart, really. Except it is a 12-tone row. And for the listeners who don't, and it's fine if you don't know what a 12-tone row is because you're about to learn. It's 12 notes in a row that don't repeat themselves. And if you're really going for the second Viennese school of 12-tone music, serial music, you're going to do a row vertically as well. So if you take a grid of 12 across and 12 down, none of the notes repeat themselves going across and none of them repeat themselves vertically going down. So it's like a puzzle. It's fun. It's not
like
how
musical Sudoku.
It's musical Sudoku, exactly. And I just delivered a piece, not for young kids, it's more of a grade 4, grade 5, called Breathe, that has yet to have its premiere because, of course, everything's shut down. But I delivered that in October, and that, too, is a 12-tone row. But you wouldn't necessarily know it by listening to it. I think the point is, don't use these things as shticks, you know, because you want people to pay attention to that. Yeah. Only use a tool because it serves your artistic purpose. When I wrote Tight Squeeze, I did not set out to write a 12-tone piece. It sort of happened that way that eight notes in, I realized that none of the notes repeated. So I figured, hey, let's go for broke and find those other four, shall we? And that's, you know, that's how I did it. But I didn't set out to do that. And the same thing with, you know, I use a lot of effects because I've got the studio and mostly I'm doing electroacoustic things. It gives me such an opportunity to use found sounds, whether it's the humpback whale in Immersion, in the third movement of Immersion, or trains in Train of Thought, or rocks in rock music, or metal bowls filled with water in Liquid Compass. And the piece the symphony I'm writing right now, the third movement, does have ping pong balls involved, however, not in the trite way you would ever, ever think of a ping pong ball, I guarantee you. So people won't necessarily figure out that these are ping pong balls making this sound.
There's beer pong in your symphony.
What?
Is there beer pong in your symphony?
There should be. You know, you just gave me a great idea. Yeah. As a matter of fact, that's what it might take to get me through this third movement, which I'm sort of... a good round of beer pong.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
You have me on beer pong now. This is great. I just want to leave now and go to the local bar.
But, yeah. Because we also did, we did passages last semester here, which was an amazing opportunity for many of my students to take their first dive into improvisation, which is, you know, another one of those things that you kind of have to be pushed off the cliff to start doing. So I'm so grateful for that piece and the opportunity of all your pieces that we can really use them to teach our students a new way of expression that isn't just the black dots on the page.
Thanks. And that's the point, isn't it? That's exactly, you know, how all of us feel, all three. It's like music can be anything you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And we say this all the time. And that it can be a gesture. It could be a noise. You know, I often make the an analogy when I'm talking to students, which I'm doing a lot of these days. I can say I can take my water glass, you know, and I promise there's not vodka in this. This is water. And I can bang my ring against it accidentally. And all that is, it's an accidental annoying noise. But then if I decide I like that sound, record it, dump it into my computer and start playing with it, I've turned that accidental, stupid, annoying noise into an intentional musical element, right? And I keep telling them that everything around them is potentially musical. So the point is to just keep your ears open, right? And I think that we grow the next crop of composers and wonderful musicians by, at the earliest age possible, getting them to hear the world around them, whether they're in a city and that world is, you know, buses and subways and sirens, or if they're out in the wilderness and it's leaves and waves, you know, and bird feathers, whatever it is. There's so much music around us.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of your piece Passages, you've been a leading force in adaptable music, which is, you know, the latest trend and the latest necessity here in 2021 in the middle of a pandemic. And so through your work with the Creative Repertoire Initiative, I know you've been doing a lot of this. So when faced with the challenge of writing for limited numbers of players and different kinds of configurations, where did your thoughts go first? Was it arranging pre-existing work or creating something brand new?
I actually tried for about 5 seconds to look at a pre-existing work and try to arrange it. And actually, the one I chose to start with was Tight Squeeze, because it was a good choice since it's largely monophonic, you know, and it's got a groove, and it would be well suited to being, you know, published as an adaptable piece. And literally, I got one page in and I was tearing my hair out because my brain just doesn't work this way. And I decided two things. One, no way, I don't have the skill set to go backwards and do this. And two, I realized that Tight Squeeze and a handful of my other pieces, actually, that were the ones that are easier and more monophonic, you know, with fewer, not this whole, you know, tone poem, colorful or colorfully orchestrated ones, but the really simple ones, mostly groove-based ones, they were already adaptable. It doesn't matter, as I like to say, three ferrets playing kazoos could show up and play Tight Squeeze or rock music or Off the Edge, and it would be fine. It would be fine. It might sound better, you know? So, like, seriously, you don't want to overthink these things. So if you have stuff for the composers who might be listening, if you have stuff in your catalog that can be, that would sound fine if half the band didn't show up, you know, and there are those pieces. They're more like, you know, when it's electroacoustic, you've got a gold mine there, because literally you've already got the track. So who knows if people are showing up or not, just play the track louder. But then what I did with Passages, this is when my other side of my crazy brain kicked in and I realized, okay, I can't do what our friends, you know, Brian Balmages or Frank Tekeli can do. They're so brilliant with understand, you know, just laying out an adaptable score and, you know, just hear the segments of who should be playing what, and it's a different way of thinking, and they're brilliant at it. My brain doesn't work that way. So how does my brain work? Passages is what I came up with. I wanted to do this thing where anybody can play any line at any time, as long, and the only rule is, you know, start and wait four bars before you come in on the next line. It's because everything had to lock up with the changing chords of the track and the through composed bass line. So that was my brain's response to Adaptable. And that's what I'm doing. I've got a couple more Adaptable pieces coming out the next couple of months, the very short little micro pieces. Mm-hmm. And it's the same concept of just a really fun free-for-all where I don't have to delineate instruments. I can just have anybody play any line, which gives everybody the chance to play all these different things, which is fun. And it takes the pressure off of me to be any good at this. But it's so important, as we know, you know, we have to have pieces like this, not just now in the pandemic, but going forward in the future, because, you know, to give educators as much and directors as much flexibility as possible with their programming choices is such a gift. It's such a good thing. It's so helpful. Mm-hmm. Hey, have you been doing a lot of Adaptable pieces, Kate?
Well, it's funny because as you were talking, I was just feeling so validated because I also felt just like my brain doesn't work this way. Last year when everybody was starting to recreate their existing catalog in a flexible format, I just could not wrap my head around that. I have since released a couple of pieces that existed already that I was able to reimagine just because of the way they were already orchestrated. It made sense for me to be able to do that. But it was actually not until I got a commission for a flexible band piece that I was finally able to kind of break out of that feeling of being stuck and not knowing what to do. So I got this commission and that made me feel much more excited because the piece was always intended to be done this way. And that makes me feel much better than taking something that exists and going backwards and trying to recreate. I didn't like that. Yep. So
we are two peas in a pod because I couldn't go backward and like get rid of all the orchestration that I had put time into creating those colors because, you know, you're used to hearing those colors. I mean, some people can
exactly.
do it. I would rather start from scratch. I'm with you. Yeah. Just imagine it from the get-go as what it's going to be.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And if you,
what
if
about you, Dylan? What about your?
Well, let me tell
pieces?
You what I got on the docket here. It's called Green Water Bottle, and that's what I have on my right. Anyway.
That's awesome. Seriously, that could be a piece right there. Everybody holds a green water bottle.
Get
Some
ready,
can
folks.
Have blue water bottles.
I usually mute my mic, but
I'm loving it. So you can sample that. Yeah. I am totally loving that.
Making Listen. Sounds and staying hydrated all at the same time.
Yeah. I'll offer a spoiler that no one has heard on a broadcast. This is not over-documented or even documented
Ooh,
at all. The piece
go.
I'm delivering next week for a set of five, a little suite of five Adaptable pieces coming from five of the founding CRI Creative Repertoire Initiative composers. We each were commissioned to write a one-minute piece. So blink and you'll miss it, which could be a good thing in my case, who knows. But at any rate, we all have, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's Pete Meakin, your former guest, Jen Jolly, Frank DeKelly, Brian Belmages, and me. And we're all doing one-minute pieces. My piece, your water bottle could actually just about qualify to be in it.
Oh,
my piece is called Kitchen Sink, SYNC. It is 1 minute
long. Oh, cool.
And Kate, you're going to dig this. This is my approach and maybe your approach to starting with an Adaptable thing. It's got basically nine parts. And seven of them are all these different categories of things you'd find in a kitchen, right? But no knives allowed. Nothing that makes flame or knives, okay?
Or
can't
trombones.
Have that. Or trombones. No trombones. Or oboe reeds. You can't have those either. Too dangerous. But it's all these things. And it's a very long list of all these items that you can make sound out of percussively. And then there are two kind of improvised drone. This is purely acoustic. It's not electroacoustic. Okay. Improvised drone lines for any players who want to play their instrument or vocalize and make undulating, pitch bending, weird sounds all based on any pitch they want. But, you know, they can just decide ahead of time what they want to do. So everybody reads off the score, which is just four pages. And it's just this percussive happiness thing. At one point, another spoiler is that, let's just say, there is a surprise guest appearance from a kitchen blender at three speeds. And which is very, very loud. But anyway, they're going to have fun with it. And the cool thing is they can, there are improvisatory sections for everybody, and everybody can play any line they want. So every time they play it, it'll be different. So, and there's a long list. And what I did was I met with the students on Zoom 2-3 weeks ago. And I had already my list of ideas of what could be played. And then they added to it at my invitation. I said, okay, what else? What else should we be playing from the kitchen? And they came up with all kinds of great things. So all of that's published in the score. So there you go. So, your water bottle, Dylan, you know?
You someday. Can play this piece. Water bottle, you're going to be famous someday.
That's right.
Okay. well, you just mentioned Zooming students, and your website says you've done more virtual residencies and interviews since 2020 than in the past 20 years. And being so well equipped, looking at that beautiful setup you have behind you, this is not the first time you've been doing it. You've been doing it for quite some time, and that's how we met. We met a Skype rehearsal kind of thing, yeah. And so I was wondering, has this work that you've done felt different this year, and this is something Kate and I have talked about. Is there a such thing as too much of this type of work?
Well, in terms of the Zooms with students, I don't think it could ever be too much, except I'm sure the students are Zoomed out, and I really feel for them. I think the teachers are understandably panicked and exhausted, and hats off to every teacher. I mean, what the teachers and directors and ensemble directors and everybody have had to deal with this year and ongoing, you know, it's just ridiculous. And they've been so great. So anything that we can do, any of us, you know, to support that, whether it's giving them music or, you know, to play, you know, new adaptable repertoire, or showing up and helping with the class and, you know, kind of giving the students another dimension of a musical experience, that's really, really good. So I think this year the difference has been there's more panic, you know, there's more desperation of, oh my gosh, what am I going to do with these kids, especially the younger ones? You know, what am I going to do with these kiddos to, you know, keep them engaged? And with the older ones, you know, I came up with the syllabus, putting the E in ensemble to keep them engaged, to keep them connected with each other, to get them using skills that if they were meeting in rehearsal in a band room, they never get to use. But now that they're online, they can collaborate with each other and connect and create and do all these things. So for me, it's been different in that way. And of course, there seemed, because we're all home a lot, there are more webinars and podcasts and everything else. I've done a lot of webinars, and those are really rewarding too. I do wonder about the overexposure, over-documented, you know, am I doing too many of them? Because, you know, basically I'm the person where, what is it? You know, you give them a phone book to read and they'll be happy to do it. you know, this people ask me to do these and I always say, sure, because I love doing it and I love connecting with people. But I realize that also, you know, people can get sick of it, but hey, they can always dial on to the next guest and, you know, click away from me. That's fine.
No, you are special. You are worth it.
Oh, and I am somebody. I can be somebody. I am. What was that Al Franken character on SNL back in the, you are special. You are somebody. I forget that character. At any rate, that's the difference. When I realized how many of these I was doing is when I actually was updating my CV. I actually have one for the rare occasion that someone wants to look at one. And it's sort of a nice, I call it good composer hygiene, you know, kind of keep track of what you're doing every year and update it, just like your catalog. And so I was updating my CV and I got to the set of, which I thought was a pretty long list of in-person residencies over the years. And then I went through my calendar and I realized, oh my gosh, this is crazy how many of these I have done. You know, I'm doing 3 to 5 a week. I mean, every week, wow. That's a lot. And so that that really is a lot. And so that's where that came from. I realized I've done more than I have over 20 years. Yeah. And that's the nature of the times. I don't think it's going to stop really, because now that everybody's on board with the, you know, Zoom, the web rehearsals, as I call them, you know, and Zooming and connecting that in a way that not everybody was before because they didn't have to be. But now that everybody's got the skill set and they're comfortable with it, they're going to continue to want this for their students. You know, it's really valuable to bring Kate in to rehearse with somebody. You know, it's so important to bring people, other people in, I think, so the students have another perspective on what they're doing. And I do think it makes the music come alive for them a little bit more when they know about Kate's cat, you know, and when they got to see the cat.
Well, yeah, and so, if there's two composers who my students freak out about, it's you two. So,
aww.
Yeah, they're big fans. Big fans.
That's awesome.
So, as listeners know, and as the two of you know, I'm a self-published composer, and Alex, I know you have your own publishing company as well, Activist Music, and more composers these days are choosing to go the self-publishing route as opposed to the more traditional working with an established publishing company. So as a board member of ASCAP, I'm curious about your perspective on artists' creative rights and the future of the music publishing world.
And that is a huge topic, and we'll barely break the surface of it, right? That's a huge topic. But basically, I think I'll simplify it because that's the only way to have this conversation right now. And by saying it's ultimately certain business models are going to change, not always for the best. The more educated and aware of the business side of music and income and production of income from intellectual property that composers are, the better for composers and the better for the arts, that the more control you can have over your career. And that does not rule out publishers, by the way. There's nothing wrong with publishers and record companies. It's just that we have options, which we didn't have before. And the point is to understand if you're a composer, what your music is potentially worth. Because it's worth something when you write it. It's worth something when you sell the sheet music for a few bucks. It could be worth an awful lot down the road if it gets used in X, Y, and Z manners, you know, because of copyright and licensing and royalties and all kinds of nice ways that artists and intellectual property owners get paid for the use of their work. So what I see is that technology is ultimately, it's simultaneously our friend and our enemy, but I like to think of it as our friend, and that we, in order to keep it from being too much of an enemy, we have to educate ourselves and understand how to protect ourselves and how to wrangle this information. Because yes, it is very easy to point to say for the past 25 years, since the mid-90s, Napster and the beginning of the whole digital, you know, peer-to-peer file sharing and all this, that suddenly put a huge dent into our income. And all things that happened since then, it's easy to point a finger and say, well, you know, now everything's free, you know, on YouTube or whatever. I'll never have enough, you know, fans to monetize anything that's coming through. I'm not making any money from these portals. That doesn't mean you can't make money. It means that you have to change in the same way that we're not making money from CDs, right? Because they basically, I mean, they exist, but not at all like they used to. It's a whole different thing. Now it's just a sonic business card that it's not an income source, but it's a business card. What you have to do as a composer is pivot and immediately say, okay, I can't do X, Y, and Z anymore the way I used to make money. But I have these new ways of making money, and a lot of money actually, that I didn't have years ago. And if I understand how to use them well and smartly, I can support myself with this whole new bag of tricks and this whole new tool set. The point is to be forward thinking, right? And to use everything to its advantage. The real point as an artist is to share your work. And that also means these days sharing yourself, as we've been talking about, you know, Zooming, making yourself available as a person to further promote and share the work. I mean, because the work is you. You are the product. It's your heart that is the music. It came directly from you, not from anyone else, not even those ferrets in the back closet. It didn't come from them. It came from you. And as a result, you are inseparable from the work itself. So if that's the case, think about all the ways, including Zooming, including all, you know, guest lectures and webinars and things like that, that are valuable in your work in a way that 20 years ago no one would be doing. And when I started doing Skypersals, as I deemed them, that was about 10 years ago. And I was one of the very few people doing them. And I remember telling my friends, you got to do these. You got to do these. They're so important. You know, and now it's a thing. Everybody does them. I'm not saying I'm the reason for that. I'm just saying I was a very early adopter and I was a cheerleader about it. And so there are, you know, what's coming down the pike is all kinds of alternative realities. And that, and much more three-dimensional, and you know, once we have, you know, Skylink and Starlink and a way that everybody can have be hooked up to reasonably fast internet, we'll have synchronous audio, and we'll have ways of connecting with each other that will be far more than just the limitations of this two-dimensional screen in pixelation, you know, that we're dealing with right now. We have to anticipate that and look forward to that and figure out how to wrangle that for the kind of work that we do. How can we put it to use? So I'm hopeful. I think that there are so many artistic opportunities ahead of us all for using the tech for good and not for evil. And finding creative ways that it's going to enhance everybody's lives, whether we're talking about, you know, artistic merit or education or anything else. I'm excited about it. I really am very curious to see what the next 10 years are going to bring. Because I think it's going to happen. It's going to start to happen a lot sooner than that. But I always use the analogy that you know, the iPhone is only like 13 or 14 years old. It's really a fairly new thing, and yet we can't live without it. We can't imagine not having it. And whatever the next thing is, which we can maybe start to describe tiny aspects of it, but none of us know really what it's going to be. But I guarantee you, it's going to be something that once we have it, we're not going to know how we lived without it. Mm-hmm. And that's very exciting to me. So that's my long answer, just the tip of the iceberg about publishing and, you know, being in control of your career, meaning be knowledgeable, be curious mm-hmm. about everything around you, understand copyright, understand tech, understand business practices, use a lawyer. If you're a composer listening to this, don't sign a contract without having someone smarter than you look at it. Someone preferably with a law degree. Because, and I say this as someone who, you know, I'm a little smarter on copyright than the average bear, and I still would not ever do any big deals without, you know, anything with significant money, meaning more than $5, you know, that without an attorney looking at it. Because things could be missing that even if you think you know what should be in contracts, you might overlook something that down the road could have provided you gazillions of dollars, many, many, many thousands of dollars, had you protected that right. And that right ended up being missing in your contract because, you know, you didn't know. You didn't know what you were missing. So that lawyers are really invaluable, I have to say.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
Yeah.
And I'd say, even for someone who's not a composer, but is full of fear for the future, you just filled me with so much hope.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah, that was, yeah. And that advice alone was worth its weight in gold. And we still have one question left, sadly. I'm actually very sad. But we are going to go on to record the most historic bonus episode ever recorded in the history of bonus episodes, folks. You should hear the whopper that Alex hit us with before we got on this call. I'm not underselling it here. This is the biggest news about Alex Shapiro that has ever been released. You need, if you are not already a contributor to our wonderful Patreon community, you need to get on this, folks. My gosh.
This alone will be worth it.
Yeah. Just stop listening right now. Go to Patreon.
Go to Patreon. Give these wonderful people money. They are so worth subscribing to. Seriously, you need this in your life. This is the fabulous information and laughs and pick-me-ups with new guests all the time that you're going to want to subscribe to. It's just a latte's worth of investment every month, and it goes to such a good cause. Patreon.
Thanks, Alex.
I watered up a little bit. Oh, dear. But so please, anyway, I'm going to stop selling it. Go. Who needs to? I don't have to sell it anymore. Did you hear that? But please go check it out. So for our final question. Oh, I just don't want it to end. Oh, my gosh. If you could give one piece of advice to an up and coming composer, what would it be? Maybe two.
Yeah, it's never just one, is it? The most important thing is to listen to yourself and trust your gut instinct. Because I wish I had done that more when I was younger. And I really do. Trust your gut. I mean, if it's telling you to go out and be an axe murderer, maybe not so much, okay? Don't trust your gut with that. But if it's legal and not going to hurt anybody, trust your gut. Because really, this is the key thing about being an artist. It is hard. We all know this. It's really hard to be an artist. It is so much easier. I mean, I'm not saying that being a checkout person at a grocery store is not hard work, but it doesn't take the kind of perseverance and thought process that wrangling these notes take every ounce of your, you know, existence from. There are a lot of other things we can do that are easier than being a composer or a conductor or an educator. And if you're going to do that and go into this marvelous world of the arts, then you want to trust your gut while doing it, because it's your gut that's leading you and compelling you to do it. That's where it comes from. So don't use your intellect to tell your gut, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm just going to do what my intellect tells me I should be doing. Because more often than not, if those two things are not aligned, your intellect and your gut, the intellect will steer you to a place that might work out okay, but you might not be as happy as you could be. And your gut will usually take you to a place of great happiness. So there's my advice. It's the advice I wish I had, that somebody had told me a long time ago, that I kind of finally figured out a number of years ago.
That's wonderful advice, not just for composers, musicians, conductors, but like any human being. I think it's important to think about that. So thank you so much for sharing that.
And it's just an addendum. I do know that being a checkout person at a supermarket is hard work. I'm just saying, I don't want anybody who is working in a supermarket to think I'm dissing them. I have great respect for that. You're on your feet all day long. It's just, it's very difficult, but it's a different kind of difficult. Mm-hmm. That's all I wanted to say.
No, yeah, I think people got that. Mm-hmm. I just want to take this chance for my thanks. I know we went back and forth on a date, and I was like, I don't know if we're going to get Alex. I don't know if we're going to get Alex. And you did not disappoint. This has been one of my most favorite conversations we've had. And I'm just so blessed to have even known you just a little tiny bit. And to share this, the idea of sharing this conversation with everyone just brings me so much immense joy, and I'm so grateful for your music in the world, but more importantly, I'm so grateful for your presence and what you put out into the universe. It's such a great gift to everyone. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us.
That is so kind of you. Thank you. That is so touching, really. That means a great deal.
Dylan, you really said it all. I have my own thoughts, of course, but you summed it up pretty well. The one thing that I will share is that, Alex, you mentioned Midwest and this being a place of many people in the industry to meet and be inspired by each other. The first time I went to Midwest and I met you, I actually wrote a little note in my journal afterwards. I tried to list all the people that I met and what I learned and all these things. And just beside your name, I said, be like her.
Oh,
and so that's my way of saying thank you for sharing everything that you've shared with us.
And you're doing much better than that, because you're being like you, which is awesome, Kate. And, you know, the whole band world is so happy to have you in it as a writer and a person. It has been so great to watch you flourish in this world over the past few years. I remember very well meeting you at Midwest. I remember very well. And I was so impressed with you at the time. And it's just been such a joy to watch you do your thing. You know,
thank you so much.
Awesome. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is beautiful.
It's such a love fest.
Thanks so much, Alex. Thanks so much for spending time with us in the band room. If you want to learn more about anything we discussed in today's episode, you should visit our website, bandroompod.com. If you like what you heard, make sure to subscribe to the band room and give us that rating and review, and maybe tell a friend how much you enjoyed it. If you really love the show, consider donating to our Patreon page, where you can donate to BRP and get some extra incentives in return, like bonus episodes, monthly Zoom hangs with me and a mystery guest, and even some BRP merch. Speaking of another way to support the podcast, you could buy some BRP merch, helping to offset podcast hosting costs and investments into new equipment so that we can continue to bring you great content and great people. Follow us on our social media at BandroomPod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube to keep up with what is on the go. And if you have any thoughts on today's episode, leave us a comment on our website. And who knows, that comment might be featured in a future episode of BRP.
A big, giant thanks to composer E.K.R. Hamill for letting us use his piece Skyline as the BRP theme music, which was performed by the University of Toronto Wind Ensemble, conducted by Dr. Jillian McKay. Stay safe and be well, bandies. Thanks again for stopping by the Band Room.